A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a deceptively simple geography question. He's asking two things. First, where do the boundaries of ancient Jerusalem actually map onto in today's city? Like, if you're walking around modern Jerusalem, where were the walls in David's time, or during the Second Temple period? And second, how large was the city during the Ottoman era? Which I think gets at something interesting. Was Jerusalem this sprawling metropolis under the Ottomans, or was it something much smaller and more contained? There's a lot to unpack here.
Oh, this is right up my alley. And by the way, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if I sound unusually coherent, that's why.
I was going to say, you're unusually coherent today. Now it makes sense.
But seriously, this question is fantastic, because most people, even people who visited Jerusalem, have a completely wrong mental map of what the ancient city actually looked like and where it sat.
I think the biggest misconception is that ancient Jerusalem and modern Jerusalem occupy the same footprint, just with newer buildings on top. And that's not even close to true.
Not even close. So let's start with the earliest Jerusalem, the City of David, because this is where the whole thing begins and it's probably the most surprising part for most listeners. The City of David, the Jerusalem that David conquered and made his capital, is not in what we think of as the Old City today. It's on a narrow ridge south of the current Old City walls, running south from the Temple Mount, bounded by two valleys, the Kidron Valley on the east and the Tyropoeian Valley, what they used to call the Valley of the Cheesemakers, on the west.
The Valley of the Cheesemakers. That's genuinely delightful. I'm imagining a lot of dairy-related commerce.
Josephus mentions it, and the name stuck. But here's the thing. That ridge is tiny. The city of David in the 10th century BCE, during David and Solomon's time, covered about 12 acres. That's it. To put that in perspective, that's about 9 football fields. The entire capital of the United Monarchy, the city that would become the center of Jewish identity for 3,000 years, fit on a sliver of land about 400 meters long and maybe 100 meters wide at its widest point.
I mean, I'm picturing my local park. That's not a city. That's a neighborhood block party.
And the population probably maxed out at around 2,000 people in the 10th century BCE. This was a fortified hilltop settlement, not a city in any modern sense. The water source was the Gihon Spring, which is down in the Kidron Valley, and they built incredible engineering works to access it. Warren's Shaft, Hezekiah's Tunnel. These are still there. You can walk through Hezekiah's Tunnel today, water up to your knees in some places.
I've done that. It's eerie and amazing. You're walking through a water channel carved through solid rock 2,700 years ago, and it still works. Water still flows through it.
That tells you something about the geography. The city had to hug that ridge because the water source was fixed. You couldn't just expand wherever you wanted. The Gihon Spring dictated the location. So for the first few centuries of Jerusalem's existence, the inhabited area was entirely on that eastern ridge south of what's now the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount itself, where the Dome of the Rock now stands, wasn't even part of the city in David's time. It was a threshing floor owned by Araunah the Jebusite. David bought it, Solomon built the temple there, and only then did the city start expanding northward.
The Temple Mount was basically the northern suburb. The original city was downhill and south.
And this is where people get confused when they visit. They stand at the Western Wall Plaza, look up at the Temple Mount, and assume they're in the heart of ancient Jerusalem. And they are, kind of, but the really ancient Jerusalem, the city of David, is further downhill, south of where they're standing. Most tourists never even go there. They see the old city, the Jewish quarter, the Christian quarter, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they think that's the ancient core. But the old city as we know it today, with its 16th century Ottoman walls, sits north of the original settlement. The city of David is outside those walls, to the south.
Let's map this onto modern streets. If someone is standing at the Dung Gate today, where are they relative to the city of David?
The Dung Gate is actually the closest gate to the City of David. You walk out of the Dung Gate, head south, and you're descending onto the ridge. The visitor center for the City of David is right there. You're walking downhill, and you can see the slope of the Kidron Valley to your left, east. To your right, you'd see the Tyropoeian Valley, though it's largely filled in now with centuries of debris and construction. But if you stand there and look north, you see the southern wall of the Temple Mount looming above you. That's the visual relationship. The original city was below the Temple Mount, not around it.
That's a great image. So the Temple Mount was literally the high point, the Acropolis, and the city huddled on the slope below it.
And over time, as Jerusalem expanded, it grew in phases. By the 8th century BCE, during the reign of Hezekiah, the city had expanded westward onto what's called the Western Hill. That's roughly where the Jewish Quarter and the Armenian Quarter sit today. Hezekiah built a new wall, the Broad Wall, to encompass this expansion. Parts of the Broad Wall are still visible in the Jewish Quarter. You can see a section of it, about 7 meters thick, right there among the modern buildings. The city had grown from 12 acres to about 150 acres by the end of the First Temple period.
From 12 acres to 150 acres. That's a more than tenfold expansion. What drove that?
When the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 BCE, a flood of refugees came south to Jerusalem. The city swelled dramatically. Archaeological evidence shows rapid, somewhat haphazard construction on the western hill during this period. The population probably jumped from a few thousand to somewhere around 25,000 in a matter of decades. Jerusalem went from a regional administrative center to a real city almost overnight, driven by geopolitical catastrophe.
That's a pattern that repeats, isn't it? Waves of refugees reshaping the city's boundaries.
Over and over. And then the Babylonians destroyed it all in 586 BCE, and the city was largely abandoned for a generation. When the exiles returned under Persian rule, they rebuilt, but the city was much smaller. Basically just the city of David Ridge again, maybe 30 or 40 acres. It wasn't until the Hasmonean period, 2nd century BCE, that Jerusalem expanded again to the western hill. And then Herod the Great, in the 1st century BCE, transformed the city completely.
This is the Second Temple period that everyone pictures, right? The Grand Jerusalem of Jesus' time.
That's the one. Herod rebuilt the temple on a massive scale, expanding the Temple Mount platform to the enormous size we see today, about 36 acres for the platform alone. The western wall that people pray at today is just a retaining wall for that platform. Herod's Jerusalem covered about 230 acres, with a population estimated between 40,000 and 80,000 people. It was a major city by ancient standards, with palaces, aqueducts, theaters, and the Antonia Fortress overlooking the temple.
230 acres. So we've gone from 12 to 150 to 230. And where were the boundaries at this peak?
The northern wall under Herod ran roughly along what's now the northern edge of the old city, near the Damascus Gate. The southern wall enclosed the city of David and the area around the Siloam Pool. The eastern boundary was the Kidron Valley, and the western boundary was roughly where the current western old city wall stands, give or take. So Herod's Jerusalem largely overlaps with what we now call the Old City, plus the City of David spurred to the south. It's actually a very similar footprint to the Old City, just shifted slightly south to include the original ridge.
Which means when people walk through the Old City today, they're largely walking within the boundaries of Herodian Jerusalem. The street level is higher, in some places 20 or 30 feet higher, but the footprint is similar.
The street level is dramatically higher. Centuries of destruction and rebuilding have raised the ground level enormously. In the Jewish Quarter, you can go down into underground archaeological sites and walk on actual Herodian-era streets, complete with shops and rubble from the Roman destruction in 70 CE. The Cardo, the main north-south street of Roman and Byzantine Jerusalem, is visible in the Jewish Quarter. Part of it is reconstructed as a shopping arcade, and part of it is excavated below street level where you can see the original paving stones.
I remember seeing those. Massive stones worn smooth by centuries of feet and cartwheels. And you realize you're standing 20 feet below where you were a minute ago, in a completely different century.
That's Jerusalem in a nutshell. The city is a layer cake. Roman Jerusalem, built after the destruction, was called Aelia Capitolina, and it was a pagan city with a temple to Jupiter on the Temple Mount. The boundaries contracted somewhat, maybe 150 acres. Then the Byzantine period saw another expansion, with churches and monasteries springing up, and the city walls extended to include Mount Zion to the southwest and the area around the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Mount Zion is interesting because it's outside the current old city walls now. So at one point it was inside?
Yes, during the Byzantine period and again during the early Islamic period, the walls enclosed Mount Zion. The current Ottoman walls, built by Suleiman the Magnificent in the 1530s, exclude Mount Zion. And there's a famous story. Supposedly, the architects who built the walls left Mount Zion out, and Suleiman had them executed for it. Their tombs are said to be near the Jaffa Gate. It's probably apocryphal, but it's a great story.
Execution for poor urban planning. That's a strong incentive to get the boundaries right.
Harsh, but effective. Now, this brings us to the second part of Daniel's question. How large was Jerusalem during the Ottoman era? And this is where things get really interesting because the answer surprises most people.
My assumption, and I think most people's assumption, is that Jerusalem under the Ottomans was this grand, sprawling city, the capital of a province, a major center of pilgrimage and trade. But I'm guessing that's wrong.
It's completely wrong. For most of the Ottoman period, Jerusalem was a small, provincial backwater. The city was confined almost entirely within the 16th century walls built by Suleiman. And those walls enclose an area of about 1 square kilometer, which is roughly 250 acres. So the Ottoman city was actually slightly larger than Herod's Jerusalem, but not by much. And for 4 centuries, from the 1530s until the mid-19th century, the city barely expanded beyond those walls at all.
So, for 400 years, Jerusalem stayed within the same walls? No suburbs, no expansion?
The population fluctuated, but it was never large by the standards of other Ottoman cities. In the 16th century, right after the Ottoman conquest, Jerusalem had maybe 10 to 15,000 people. By the early 19th century, it had actually shrunk. Some estimates put the population as low as 8 or 9,000. It was a small, poor provincial town. The economy was driven primarily by religious pilgrimage and some local agriculture. There was no industry to speak of, no major trade routes passing through. Jerusalem was a backwater.
That's hard to square with the city's significance in 3 major religions. You'd think that would drive growth.
Religious significance doesn't always translate to economic or political power. And the Ottomans governed Jerusalem as part of the Damascus Islet for most of their rule, then later as part of the Vilayet of Syria. It wasn't even its own provincial capital for much of the Ottoman period. The real centers of power in the region were Damascus, Cairo, and Istanbul. Jerusalem was a place of pilgrimage, sure, but pilgrims came, they prayed, they left. They didn't build industries or establish trade networks.
What did the city actually look like inside those walls? I'm picturing a dense, medieval-style urban core.
The old city as it exists today, with its dense warren of alleyways, its quarters, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Armenian, that's largely an Ottoman creation in terms of urban fabric. The city was divided into these quarters, not by formal decree, but organically, with each community clustering around its holy sites. The Muslim quarter around the Temple Mount and the Haram al-Sharif. The Christian quarter around the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Jewish quarter near the Western Wall. The Armenian quarter around the Cathedral of St. James.
The Jewish quarter today is quite small, right? I mean, within the old city.
The Jewish quarter is about a sixth of the old city, maybe 15 acres. And during the Ottoman period, it was even smaller and extremely poor. The Jewish community in Jerusalem was largely dependent on charitable donations from diaspora communities, the Halukah system. Living conditions were harsh, overcrowding, poor sanitation, disease. The population density inside the walls was incredibly high because nobody wanted to live outside the walls. It wasn't safe.
That's the key, isn't it? The walls weren't decorative. They were functional.
Until the mid-19th century, leaving the city walls at night was dangerous. Bedouin raids, bandits, general lawlessness in the countryside. The walls were locked at sunset, and if you were outside, you were on your own. So everyone crowded inside, even as the population grew. By the 1850s and 60s, the city inside the walls was bursting at the seams. The Jewish quarter in particular was notoriously overcrowded, with families crammed into tiny rooms and courtyards.
When did that start to change? When did Jerusalem finally burst out of Suleiman's walls?
The mid-19th century is the turning point. Several things happened simultaneously. The Ottoman Empire began a series of reforms, the Tanzimat, which improved security and administration in the provinces. The European powers, Britain, France, Russia, Germany, started establishing consulates and building institutions in Jerusalem. And the Crimean War in the 1850s brought a lot of European attention and investment to the region.
Jewish immigration was picking up too, right?
The first major expansion beyond the walls was actually driven by the Jewish community. In 1860, Sir Moses Montefiore, the British Jewish philanthropist, funded the construction of Mishkanot Sha'ananim, the first Jewish neighborhood outside the old city walls. It's just across the Hinnom Valley, directly facing Mount Zion. You can still see the windmill he built there, the Montefiore windmill. It's a landmark now.
I've seen it. It's a striking structure, and it feels like it's marking a boundary, a transition point between the ancient city and the modern one.
That's exactly what it is. Mishkanot Sha'ananim was revolutionary. Living outside the walls was terrifying. The first residents only stayed during the day at first, retreating back inside the walls at night. But gradually, as security improved and more neighborhoods were built, the psychological barrier was broken. By the 1880s and 90s, dozens of new Jewish neighborhoods were springing up outside the walls, forming what became the New City. Mia Shearim, built in 1874, is one of the oldest and most famous. The German colony, founded by German Templars in the 1870s, the Bukharan Quarter, and so on.
By the end of the Ottoman period, what did Jerusalem look like? How large was it?
By 1900, Jerusalem had grown significantly. The population had swelled to around 55,000 to 60,000 people, about half Jewish, and the rest split between Muslims and Christians. The city now extended well beyond the walls, with new neighborhoods stretching along the Jaffa Road corridor to the west, toward the German colony to the south, and up toward what's now the Mea Shearim area to the north. The total built-up area was probably around 3 to 4 square kilometers, so 3 to 4 times the size of the walled city itself.
We went from 1 square kilometer for 4 centuries to 3 or 4 square kilometers by the end of Ottoman rule. That's a dramatic expansion in just 50 years.
That pattern accelerated under the British mandate after 1917. The British brought modern urban planning, zoning laws, and infrastructure. They mandated that all new buildings be faced in Jerusalem stone, which is why the city has that distinctive golden limestone look today. By 1948, Jerusalem covered maybe 10 square kilometers. And today, the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem encompass about 125 square kilometers.
125 square kilometers. So from 1 square kilometer under the Ottomans to 125 today, that's a 125-fold increase in a little over a century.
That's where the map really gets complicated. The modern municipal boundaries of Jerusalem include areas that were separate villages until very recently, Ein Kerem, Malha, Silwan, Shuafat. These were distinct Arab villages or Jewish settlements that got absorbed into the expanding city. So when we talk about contemporary Jerusalem, we're talking about a much larger and more complex entity than the ancient or Ottoman city.
That creates a fascinating tension, doesn't it? Because the Jerusalem of the Bible, the Jerusalem of the Crusaders, the Jerusalem of Suleiman the Magnificent, that's all contained in a tiny patch of land, most of it within those 16th century walls. But the Jerusalem of today, the Jerusalem people actually live in and argue about and draw borders around, is a sprawling modern city that extends far beyond anything the ancients would have recognized.
That's the core insight I think Daniel's question gets at. The boundaries of ancient Jerusalem map onto today's city in a very specific and limited way. The city of David is a narrow ridge south of the old city. Herodian Jerusalem largely overlaps with the old city plus that southern ridge. The Ottoman city is essentially identical to the walled old city. Everything else. West Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, the new neighborhoods, the industrial zones, the university campuses, all of that is a product of the last 150 years.
If you're walking down Jaffa Street today, past the cafes and the light rail and the modern apartment buildings, you're walking on land that in 1850 was open countryside. Olive groves, maybe some terraced agriculture, but not city.
Jaffa Street was the road to Jaffa, the port city. It was a route, not a street. The neighborhoods along it now, Mahane Yehuda, the market area, the central bus station area, none of that existed in Ottoman times. Mahane Yehuda Market started as an open-air market in the late 19th century, named after a neighborhood built by the Mahane Yehuda Society in 1887. Before that, it was just fields.
The light rail, which seems so permanent and modern, runs roughly along the old Jaffa Road route. So, you're literally riding a tram along what was a donkey path to the coast 400 years ago.
Layers upon layers. That's Jerusalem. Every street, every building, every stone has a history, and the history is compressed into this incredibly small geographic area. I mean, consider this. Within a 15-minute walk from the Jaffa Gate, you can visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Western Wall, the Dome of the Rock, and the City of David. That's 4,000 years of history in a radius of maybe a kilometer.
That's actually mind-bending when you say it that way. Most ancient cities sprawl or shift over time. Rome, Athens, Cairo. But Jerusalem's sacred core has stayed in exactly the same place, just getting denser and taller and more layered.
That's because the geography didn't change. The Gihon Spring is still there. The Temple Mount is still there. Golgotha, where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre stands, is still there, though it was outside the walls in Jesus' time and is inside the walls now. The holy sites are anchored to specific locations, and the city grew around and on top of them. You can't move the Temple Mount. You can't move the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So the city just kept piling up on the same spot.
Which brings me to something I've been thinking about. You mentioned earlier that the street level in the old city is 20 or 30 feet higher than in ancient times. That means the ancient city is literally underneath the modern one. How much of it is accessible?
Only a fraction. There are archaeological tunnels and excavations, the Western Wall tunnels, the City of David excavations, the Herodian Quarter in the Jewish Quarter. But the vast majority of ancient Jerusalem is still buried under centuries of construction, and that creates an enormous tension between preservation and development. Every time someone wants to build a new building or dig a foundation, there's a chance they'll hit something archaeologically significant. It slows everything down and makes construction incredibly expensive and politically fraught.
I've seen that firsthand. Daniel has mentioned watching the city get dug up for infrastructure work. You can't put a shovel in the ground in Jerusalem without an archaeologist showing up.
That's not an exaggeration. Israeli law requires archaeological surveys before any construction in Jerusalem. The Israel Antiquities Authority has enormous power to halt or modify projects. And they find things constantly. Roman roads, Byzantine mosaics, Crusader foundations, Ottoman cisterns. It's a city where the past is literally inescapable.
Let me pull this back to Daniel's question and try to synthesize. If you want to map ancient Jerusalem onto today's city, you need to think in layers. The earliest layer, the City of David, is a narrow ridge south of the old city walls, east of the Dung Gate, sloping down toward the Kidron Valley. The second temple layer, Herod's Jerusalem, largely overlaps with the current old city, extending south to include the City of David. The Ottoman layer is essentially identical to the walled old city, 1 square kilometer, give or take. And everything beyond those walls, the vast majority of what we call Jerusalem today, is a modern creation of the last 150 years.
That's a perfect summary. And I'd add one more layer. The Byzantine and early Islamic periods, which expanded the city to include Mount Zion and areas around the Temple Mount, but those boundaries fluctuated. The walls moved several times between the Roman destruction and the Ottoman construction. The current walls are the most stable and long-lasting boundary in Jerusalem's history, which is ironic because Suleiman built them relatively late in the 1530s. The city had already existed for 2,500 years by then.
Suleiman's walls are still standing. You can walk on them. The ramparts walk takes you along the top of the walls, and you can look down into the old city on one side and out of the modern city on the other. It's this perfect visual metaphor. Ancient inside, modern outside, and the wall as the dividing line.
That dividing line is surprisingly sharp. Walk through the Jaffa Gate, and within 50 meters you're in a completely different world. Narrow stone alleyways, markets, churches, synagogues, mosques. The sounds change, the light changes. It's like stepping through a portal, and then walk back out and you're on a busy modern street with the light rail and traffic and 21st century everything.
The portal effect is real. I've experienced it. It's disorienting in the best way.
Now, one thing I want to add about the Ottoman period, because Daniel specifically asked about it, is that the population numbers can be deceptive. When we say Jerusalem had 8 or 9,000 people in the early 19th century, that sounds tiny. And it was tiny. But it was also incredibly dense. The walled city is only 1 square kilometer, and within that, there were courtyards, alleyways, multi-story buildings, underground cisterns. Every inch was used. The population density inside the walls in the 19th century was probably higher than many modern cities.
That's a good corrective. Low total population, but extreme density. Everyone packed into that 1 square kilometer.
The sanitary conditions were atrocious. No proper sewage system, water supply from cisterns that collected rainwater, garbage in the streets. Disease was rampant. Cholera outbreaks were common. The British, when they took over in 1917, were horrified by the conditions inside the walls and made sanitation a top priority.
Which goes back to your point about why people finally moved outside the walls. It wasn't just that it became safe enough. It was that inside the walls had become unbearable.
Push and pull factors. The push was overcrowding and disease. The pull was the availability of land, fresh air, and modern amenities in the new neighborhoods. Mishkanat Sha'ananim had its own windmill and cistern and was designed with ventilation and sanitation in mind. It was a model of modern urban planning for its time, at least by the standards of 19th century Jerusalem.
That model spread. Each new neighborhood outside the walls was built by a different community or philanthropic society, often with a specific character. The German colony looked like a German village. Mia Sherim looked like an Eastern European shtetl. The Bukharan quarter had Central Asian architectural influences. Jerusalem became this patchwork of micro-neighborhoods, each with its own identity.
That patchwork is still visible today if you know where to look. The German colony has its distinctive red-tiled roofs and stone houses with German inscriptions. Mea Sharim has its synagogues and yeshivas and the distinctive dress of its residents. The Bukharan quarter has its ornate courtyards and Central Asian motifs. These neighborhoods are now surrounded by modern apartment buildings and commercial districts, but their cores are preserved.
When we talk about Ottoman Jerusalem, we're really talking about two distinct phases. The long phase, from the 1530s to the 1850s, when the city was entirely within Suleiman's walls, and the short, explosive phase at the end of Ottoman rule, from the 1860s to 1917, when the city burst its walls and spread into the surrounding countryside.
That second phase is really the birth of modern Jerusalem. The old city became the historic core, the sacred center, but the living, breathing, growing city moved outward. By the time the Ottomans lost Jerusalem to the British in 1917, the population outside the walls was already larger than the population inside. That was a historic shift. For the first time in 3,000 years, most Jerusalemites lived outside the city walls.
That's a remarkable statistic. 3,000 years of walled living, and then in the span of 50 years, the majority of the population moves outside. That's a revolution.
It's a revolution driven by technology and security. Modern policing and military control of the countryside made living outside the walls safe. Modern water infrastructure, pumped from aquifers rather than collected in cisterns, made it possible to build away from the natural springs. The railroad, built in the 1890s connecting Jerusalem to Jaffa, made it easier to bring in building materials and supplies. All of these factors converged in the late Ottoman period to transform Jerusalem from a walled medieval city into a modern urban center.
Yet the old city remains the heart. Politically, religiously, culturally, everything revolves around that 1 square kilometer, which is, when you think about it, an incredible concentration of meaning in a tiny physical space.
There's nothing else quite like it. Other ancient cities have historic cores. Rome has the Forum. Athens has the Acropolis, but Jerusalem's entire sacred geography is compressed into an area you can walk across in 20 minutes. The Western Wall, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Dome of the Rock, the Via Dolorosa, the Tower of David, all within a few hundred meters of each other. It's the most concentrated sacred space on the planet.
That concentration is what makes the boundaries question so interesting. Because those boundaries aren't just physical. They're political, religious, psychological. Where ancient Jerusalem ends and modern Jerusalem begins is a question with real-world implications. It's not just an academic exercise.
When people argue about Jerusalem's status, about which parts belong to whom, about where borders should be drawn, they're arguing about history as much as geography. And the history is layered and complex and doesn't give easy answers. The city of David is outside the old city walls. Mount Zion was inside the walls during some periods and outside during others. The Temple Mount has been the center of Jewish worship for 3,000 years and the site of Islamic holy places for over 1,300 years. None of these layers can be simply erased or ignored.
That's why Daniel's question, as simple as it sounds, cuts to the heart of something much bigger. Understanding where ancient Jerusalem actually was, physically, on the ground, is essential to understanding what people are even talking about when they talk about Jerusalem. It's not an abstraction. It's a real place with real boundaries that have shifted and changed over millennia.
The Ottoman period is particularly important because it's the most recent layer before the modern era. The Ottoman walls define what most people think of as the old city. The Ottoman administrative divisions shape the quarters. The Ottoman land ownership patterns still influence property disputes today. If you want to understand modern Jerusalem, you have to understand the Ottoman city that preceded it.
1 square kilometer, 400 years, and then everything changed.
Now Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Ottoman Empire's smallest administrative unit was the Nahiye, and in 1876, the Nahiye of Aksadak in eastern Anatolia held the record for the empire's most absurdly large kadalk, a single Islamic judge's jurisdiction, covering over 18,000 square kilometers, roughly the size of Kuwait, despite having fewer than 12,000 residents, meaning the Qadu had to travel up to 6 days by mule to hear a single property dispute.
6 days by mule for a property dispute. That's dedication to jurisprudence.
People complain about commuting to traffic court.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, and to Daniel for the question. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're enjoying the show. We'll be back next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.